Okay.
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 No, no, no.
There, Sean.
There.
I'm going to show.
Here you go.
What's this?
That's the microphone. That's part of the microphone.
Do any of you need me to use a microphone?
Why don't you try it and see?
No, I try it without. I'm not going to use the microphone. I'm not mechanical. I have a small part this evening that members of the show will be pleased to know, and that is to welcome our guest, not a guest speaker so much as a guest interviewee. First of all, I would like to thank Marsha and Gershon for welcoming us here.
Thank you. Thank you.
We shall hopefully revert to the show in future, but this is wonderful. I'm going to put my reading specs on so that you can hear me. Pardon?
We can hear you better.
You don't want to hear me, I don't blame you. Okay. Rabbi Pruzansky is the rabbi and has been for 23, 24 years of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun of Teaneck, New Jersey, which apparently is in the United States, and is an Orthodox congregation of approximately 800 member families. Families. I saw on one thing on my computer, or 600 member families, and to have a difference.
Members and affiliates.
And affiliates, whatever they are, and to have a difference of 200 member or affiliates, it's enormous, isn't it? Even the difference. And it just recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. During that period, this blog says, it has been the catalyst for the development of Teaneck as one of the premier Orthodox communities in the United States, with the full variety of local Jewish establishments, as well as close to a dozen other shuls in their vicinity. It's described here as a classic mega shul. Now, I can understand. Well, what's a classic mega shul? Maybe you'll tell us later. A classic mega shul. But in the variety of minyanim catering to different needs and personalities, they retain the small shul feel of closeness and camaraderie. Then it says, in the first person, I try to bring a passion and verve to my activities, whether through my shiurim, drashot, or activism. We are extremely proud to be in the forefront of American shuls that have fought for the right of Jewish settlement throughout the land of Israel, and even prouder of the contributions we have made to Israel. He then says, be glad to know I'm nearly finished. Personally, I am a graduate of Columbia University in Cardozo School of Law. I'm a zmach of Yeshiva B'nai Torah under the leadership of Rav Yisro Chait, and practiced law for 13 years in New York City. Well, I practiced law for over 40 years and never got it right. I mean, you don't know what he did. Before coming to Teaneck and B'nai Yeshurun in 1994. Then he finishes, despite the shul's size, I make every effort to know every member family, i.e., if they want me to know them, and they want to know me. We welcome you.
Thank you.
Those who are members of the shul will know that I started, instead of having frontal talks, on occasion have an interview. And that's going to be the format today. We've had some outstanding interviews so far. And we'll determine later if you add to the list. Of
Don't get your hopes up.
They're not.
But doesn't it depend upon the interviewer?
And that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Do you want to? I've been looking for it. I've never met Rav Pruzansky. I've heard of him. I've heard of his community. And through this interview process, we'll get some of his thoughts and ideas through my questions. And pretty spontaneous. There are one or two issues I want to cover. And then, and only then, after we've done the interview, like has been the ground rules for all of them, we'll open it up and you can ask whatever you want. And you can answer whatever you want. And
within reason.
Pardon me?
Within reason.
Within reason. At the beginning, what Michael read, you went from being a lawyer to being a rabbi. Why?
Thank you, Rabbi Sultanic. It's a question I've been asked before. Let me first thank you for inviting me.
Okay.
Most appreciated. Thank the Dalins for hosting, and Michael, the chairman, for the introduction. Yes, I always wanted to be in the rabbinate, I guess from the time I was an early teenager, and I wanted to make a living as well. So what I did was I went to law school, and right after law school, I went back to yeshiva. And I practiced law, so for the first 9 years of my rabbinate, I started in 1985, I did both. I practiced law, and then I was rabbi of a shul in Queens, in Kew Gardens Hills. When I moved to Teaneck in 1994, it was a full-time job, so I had to give up the law at that point. And since then, I haven't practiced law, and I've been in Teaneck. One of my colleagues said quite eloquently that you exchange the profits of the law for the law of the prophets. And basically, that's what it was. The rule of thumb, by the way, is the membership is large, but it increases while I'm away. Then it decreases once I get back. So
they're at a climax.
That's
now.
Correct. That's correct.
You practiced. You didn't do it for real?
Michael can answer that question.
I will...
Law's not so bad, but they say people practice medicine also. That's what I mean.
One thing that I'll just say briefly, this issue came up when I was a rabbi in Australia, where a lawyer stood up and said, you're not allowed to do this and this and this before the Board of Deputies. And we went to visit, at that time, the foreign minister, Peacock, and they felt that we were... the group of rabbis that I led was interfering. It was over this Soviet Jewry issue. And I said to him, we are the same profession, to the guy who stood up publicly and condemned me. He said, what do you mean we're the same profession? He says, you're a lawyer, I'm a lawyer. He says, no, you're a rabbi. He said, just like that, you're a rabbi. So I said to him, I have a law degree. It's not a teaching degree. Smicha is a law degree. There are certain, like you, you're a criminal lawyer, which he was, and I have a law degree, and I have two smicha, and I explained it to him. So you didn't switch professions.
That's correct.
You just got additional degree.
I know many people who were both lawyers and rabbis. Started with my father, Olva Shalom, but I grew up in Rabbi Weinshul in Muncie.
Yes,
he started as an attorney also and went into the rabbinate.
Okay.
So it's a very natural move. It's almost a lateral move in a certain sense.
I want to ask you to start off with something very, very touchy and sensitive, okay? Were you happy the Patriots won?
Yeah, so the truth is, I didn't really have a rooting interest. You know, if it's not the local team, the Giants or the Jets, it doesn't really affect me one way or the other.
Okay.
Right, I actually got up, wasn't planning on it, got up and watched the first half.
Yeah.
And then I went to sleep. Who won in the end?
You don't know who won?
The Jewish team.
Great game. Now, in the rabbinate, you face many challenges and highs and I'm sure lows. What don't you like about the rabbinate? Not what you do. What don't you like?
Well, you can't say you don't like it, but obviously the most difficult situation you encounter is death. Certainly death of a child, you know, we've had a number of those, as every community does. And it's painful. Death of a spouse at a young age, but even an older age is difficult to deal with also. So you never wake up in the morning and look forward to those situations.
What do you wake up in the morning and look forward to?
Going back to sleep at night. But I look forward in the morning, actually, to the day. You know, I don't drink coffee, so I get up, I go to shul, and then I begin my day. I head to the office right after shul. Has paperwork to catch up on, and the phone rings during the day, and you have time to learn. The truth is, the beauty of the rabbinate is that essentially you're remunerated to do mitzvahs. How could you have a better job than that?
Mm-hmm. A payroll.
We are not paid for those. Not in this world or the next. But to be involved in Melechet Shamayim from the morning to the night, so there's no more rewarding career. So the truth is, you don't know the joke, you know, it's no job for a Jewish boy. I never felt that. I don't think non-Jews will be able to handle Jewish congregants. So it's definitely a job for a Jew. But the fact is, to be a rabbi, to be in the rabbinate, I've been blessed in that I've never really had some of the rough, even abusive experiences that I know some of my colleagues have had. I've been spared that. And I don't know if it's a tribute to me, but it's definitely a tribute to the congregations that I've led.
What do you define as someone who's dati?
Well, there's a self-definition involved, but I keep it simple. Shmirat Shabbat, Shmirat Kashrut, person davens, and that's it. I don't like to probe into people's private lives.
Okay, let me
Who do you want to expose here?
You. Let me ask you this. Something that touches me greatly. You've been here during the time when Run Rav was released from prison, and another one, almost on the same day, went into prison. You know who I'm talking about.
Right. Well, I know the latter, the former
Rabbi...
Pinto, right.
Yeah,
okay.
Pinto. And it was within a week. And
well, the prisoners should not feel the loss of a rabbi. There should always be someone there.
Okay, but even the gatekeeper was a rabbi. Uh-huh. Rav Bariach. So, but I want to ask you something. And I'm only confining myself to the Orthodox community in this. If you look not only here, but you look, and I can name names in Australia. I've lived in all these areas in South Africa and my travels. We see too often Rabbanim who either are involved, and it's not just one group. There's YU graduates, there's Haridim, there's Chabadniks in Australia. Too many Rabbanim who either are involved in sexual abuse or in corruption or in bribery, and I can go on and on. And also within the Orthodox community, would you label somebody, first question, who involves themselves in these activities as dati?
Well, again, you have to distinguish between a person's commitments and their ability to adhere to those commitments. In other words, we take for granted that people sin. If you posit that a person is dati only if they're perfect, then none of us will be dati. Now, there are gradations of sin, obviously, and some are more severe than others, and certainly the problems are exacerbated when you have rabbis or prominent people who are guilty of improper behavior. But one important definition that I would add is, does the person accept the Torah? If you accept the Torah, you accept all Tayag Mitzvot, all right, and endeavor to fulfill them, then I'll consider you dati. Even though you stumble, we're all going to stumble on occasion. And then beyond that, it's up to the It's up to the court system, the legal system. The truth is, people can agree or disagree, of course. I think the rate of impropriety amongst rabbis is actually less than you find in other professions. The doctors go to prison, the lawyers go to prison, they're certainly businessmen go to prison. It's shocking when it happens to a rabbi, priest, minister, etc., because they purport moral behavior. So it becomes a greater story. It's a more, I think it eats away at people more because the expectations are much higher for a rabbi than, I guess, say, for nothing personal, than for a lawyer. The expectations are greater, and when those expectations are not met, then the sense of deflation is greater as well. And yet, you know, what does the Gemara say? Kol ha'gadol mechaveiro, yitzhar gadol himenu. A person who's greater, means greater aspirations than someone else, has a greater yetzer hara than someone else. The more you're capable of, the greater potential for spiritual greatness, the greater potential for spiritual degradation as well. And it's elastic. And that really is the problem. In my second book, I hope you would have mentioned that, by the way.
I'm going to.
So in the last chapter, I actually discussed what I found to be the first example of religious corruption that you have in Tanakh, but real religious corruption. It's in my book called Judges for Our Time, and it's about the sons of Eli HaKohen. Eli HaKohen, of course, was in Shiloh, and his sons began to do a number of things, delay the women and their burnt offerings and take money from people. And both the realms in which they operated were the two realms of temptation that exist until today, power and money. And both of them, to some extent, are aphrodisiacs. So therefore, if you look for power and try to accumulate too much power, it's not going to be good. Power corrupts. All right, so a rabbi never has absolute power, but power does corrupt if you internalize it. And certainly the lure of money is going to be have a corrosive influence as well. And I remind Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said that just like a person in the laws of Yichud, you can't be alone with a woman, not your wife. A man should not be alone with money that's not his either, because the temptation is there as well.
I'm living up to that.
So again, dati is going to be based on commitment, and there's a recognition that we're all sinners, though, to a certain extent.
I could debate you on
that's
this
fine.
Because, but I don't want to get into a debate. I would not define anybody bein adam l'chaveiro that transgresses that and does the three things you mentioned, Shabbat,
right.
Tfila. I would not classify him as
what Dati. About, I'll interview you, what about Lashon Hara then? Persons that routinely speaks Lashon Hara.
Not Dati. That's right.
Okay.
It's a break. You mentioned a commitment to the Torah and the commandments.
Right.
And that's all of them.
Right. And yet Chazal say that everyone is guilty of at least avak Lashon Hara, the dust of Lashon Hara. Is anyone here Dati? No hands.
Now, by the way, did you hear about the... I was accused in South Africa
No, that was a good opening to a sentence. You got their attention.
It works. Okay. Actually was in Australia, I'll get to that later. But I was accused in South Africa of bemeaning the rabbinate when I got up and I said, the rabbis of South Africa do not speak about Israel. And one rabbi, and I won't mention his name, attacked me and said, what do you mean I don't speak about Israel? I speak about allow flying on Shabbat. I speak about the issue of the political issues, and he went through a whole list. And I said, "You don't speak about Israel." So what do you mean? He says, "You don't talk about Israel in terms of being ours. You don't speak about the concept of Israel, the importance of Israel." And you definitely don't demand Aliyah, which is one of the mitzvot, like you demand Kashrut and Shomer Shabbat. Your reaction to this?
I'm on your side. You could look at the Torah as a God's narrative for creating a nation and bringing them to the land of Israel. From the first Rashi, why does the Torah start with the creation of the world? No one's a witness to it. Start with the first mitzvah. No, to teach us the land of Israel is ours. From the creation of the birth of Avram and his selection in the land of Israel, lech lecha me'artzecha, go to the land of Israel, to the very end of the Torah. I mean, we're reading the parashiyot that deal with the Exodus from Egypt. What's the Exodus about? God comes to Moshe in the Sneh, Boer, the burning bush, and says to Moshe, you're going to take them out to where? Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, the first time the expression is used in the Torah. It's the third parak of Shemot, when God tells Moshe, this is where you're going. All leading up to the very end of the Torah, where Moshe has us on the banks of the Jordan, poised to enter the land of Israel. So the whole Torah is to create a nation, give them a Torah, meaning a constitution, representing God's morals and ideas, and bring them into the land of Israel to build the model state. But I agree with you, I've always found it to be a tremendous deficiency in much of the modern rabbinate. That, I don't mean modern in terms of modern Orthodox, I mean the contemporary rabbinate, that Israel is a source of criticism, correct? Sometimes fundraising, but never in terms of what God's intention was in creating a nation and giving it a land. And very often we hear the critique from our enemies that God is not in the real estate business. We hear that in America. Well, the fact is, He is. Yatsev Gvot Amim Mispar B'nei Yisrael. He arranges the borders of nations to suit us. I have no doubt that all the turmoil in this region not only impacts Israel in the present, but is shaping our destiny in the future. God chose a particular real estate in the world to give to the Jewish people as their only home, and therefore, one of the main objectives of the Torah is Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. But I think, and it's a very good topic to discuss, especially here, you're here, while I'm here, is that I've noticed among some of my colleagues that Aliyah is not mentioned, because it raises the uncomfortable question, Yofeh Doresh Velo Yofeh Mekayim. It's a great drasha, but why are you here? All right? And I think it's a deficiency, because there's a way for a rabbi to address this issue, and yet, if not account for why he's not there, acknowledge a deficiency, that he's not living in Israel, which is the complete fulfillment of the Jew. But they'd rather not go down that route. Also, I don't know if the people are amenable to it, which is not a reason not to do it, but I have to tell you, I think my second or third year in B'nai Ashurin, I gave a series on Monday nights called Torah Topics, all right? Every possible topic, I think I had eventually 50 or 60, every possible you could think of, and every week at 40, 50 people came out, except for the week I spoke about Aliyah, six people. All family, by the way.
44
Right, right. No. So it also raises uncomfortable questions for the audience. You know, there are people who don't want to come to shul and feel guilty. All right. Some people, dafko, want to feel guilty, but there are Jews who don't want to feel guilty. They want to feel good, and therefore, it's almost symbiotic that the rabbi doesn't mention it for his own reasons. Then the people don't have to hear for their own reasons. But I think that's a chisaron.
Okay. The culmination of that, and I won't even mention the title because you'll know the individual in South Africa, stood up publicly and said, if everybody listened to you, we won't have a Jewish community left here in Johannesburg.
Right. And why would that be bad?
I think it would be great. Have you ever been to Jonah?
I have not been.
When you go, learn how to duck.
Okay. I've heard about it. We have a place in America like that also. But you know, that's part of it. There's an element of truth in it. Israel relies on having strong communities in the exile. On the other hand, a lot of it is just a rationalization. It feels good to say, and I recognize that. It feels good to say it, and we try to do good things.
All right.
By the way, I should go off on a tangent. I was talking to my wife about this a few weeks ago. One of the things that I've seen in the long time I've been in Teaneck is that the younger generation, and I mean couples in their 20s and 30s, are much less Zionistic than couples who are now in their 50s and 60s. And I'm not just talking about Aliyah, which is, of course, important, because they make Aliyah also. You know, thank God we have about 20 B'nai Asherim children, including their daughter. We have 20 B'nai Asherim children just living in Modi'in alone, you know, children of our members. But I think what's happened is a similar phenomenon to what's happened here. The older generation, forget those who lived through the era of the Holocaust and Mohammed al-Shahrur, they lived through the Six-Day War. They live through the Yom Kippur War. It's a different Israel. They relate to it in a different way. They see an embattled Israel that needs our identification, needs support. The people now in the 20s and 30s, and even 40s, have no recollection of the Six-Day War or of the Yom Kippur War. All they know, what they read, is that Israel's an occupier, and it's the most powerful army in the Middle East, and they don't feel that same, I don't want to say kinship, but that same affinity or emotional connection. No, they'll visit and they'll even send their kids to learn here, but they don't feel it's less of a priority in their lives than it was in the previous two generations.
How would you overcome that?
That's a good question. One way I try to overcome that is by talking about it. And sometimes people wonder, like, why am I mentioning it? Why am I speaking about Israel? And it's to try to ignite them, to light a fire under them. They should feel that connection. And the connection not through, you know, just visiting. I think it was Rabbi Riskin who called Israel the religious Disneyland. You know, you go to Disneyland, you go on the rides in Israel. You go on the rides, and you go back to where you were. You had a fun time, you go back. But Israel can't be that for Jews. It has to touch something much more deeper in our soul in order to have that connection. And that's something that has to be sparked in the younger generation.
Do you think it's being spoken about enough, that connection, in our Orthodox yeshivot?
Well, I'm not dodging the question. I'm just being honest. I can't answer you fairly. I just don't know. I know there are schools that have, say, in the senior year, a curriculum on Zionism, which is important. But not all schools do. And I think the assumption is that when kids come here in their gap year, they're coming to learn. Almost every yeshiva, though, will take off some time to tour, but it's almost a break. It wasn't like, maybe it is, but you know, when I was here in 1975, 76, when we went out Tuesday afternoon every week touring, it was with Tanakh in hand. Tanakh in hand. And we went everywhere. We had Sinai then also, but from north to south, from Knesset to Sharm el-Sheikh. It was a different feeling when you go with the Tanakh in hand, because you're not touring Israel, you're learning Israel. To learn Eretz Yisrael is as valuable to a Jew and as important to a Jew's spiritual identity as learning Baba Kama, especially since the Torah speaks about Eretz Yisrael, but not Baba Kama in those terms. You know, of course, the halachos are there, the mitzvahs are there. But to learn Eretz Yisrael is something that the younger generation has to do as well. Not just visit this site or that site as a tourist, because the tourist doesn't always have that connection. I mentioned when I was back in December, I took a non-Jewish couple who were visiting evangelical Christians, took them for a day to different parts of Israel. It said to me that, take us wherever you want to take us. What do you think is important? As we started, I took them on the tunnel tour in the old city, went to the Jewish quarter, all around there, and I took them for a drive to Shiloh. All right? Shiloh. So they should see what the Shomron is. Don't believe what you read in the papers about the settlements and land grabbing and the oppression, etc. See, and you know, she chopped in 5 minutes what diplomats never chab. There's so much land here. I mean, don't you travel up Route 60, you don't really see Arabs. You look around. There's a village in the distance, and there's a settlement in the distance as well. Anyway, we stood at Shiloh, and you know, to them, they're from North Carolina, Shiloh, and they're overwhelmed by it, Shiloh. And they knew the whole story. Eli, Hannah, Samuel, Eli's sons, they knew the whole story. They could not believe they're standing on the ruins of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle in Shiloh. And I thought to myself then, I shared this with the shul when I was there in December, it would be something if we could have that same enthusiasm. You know, the first time is always the first time. But nonetheless, to stand on our roots, all right, and this is not even 3,000 years ago. This is 3,300 years ago, all right? Shmuel is my namesake, that's my Hebrew name. To stand where they were, where his mother prayed, where Eli HaKohen was, it's a wonderful opportunity. I understand not many people want to travel to Shiloh these days, but it's a big mistake. You know, they renovated the Mishkan, and there's a whole museum now, there's a movie, it's really done wonderfully. But they experienced what they saw as their biblical roots. Allah had kama v'kama, that we should be able to experience that as well. To take young people there, middle-aged people there, and say, this is where we came from. This is you. This is you.
Let me... you're familiar with Israel. I know you are. Asking about the institution of the chief rabbinate. Is it relevant? Is... You can't hear?
No.
You're better off.
You all know.
Pardon?
You all know.
It's the institution of the chief rabbinate. It's a point of contention. I'm pretty sure you know Rav Soloveitchik's view about the chief rabbinate when he was asked to be chief rabbi. Do you believe that it is relevant today in structure and in content?
The short answer is yes. The truth is Rav Soloveitchik was not offered the job. He was proposed for the job with a number of other candidates.
Yes.
And he had a bad experience here already in 1935. Some of you may remember. No, I'm kidding. He came to apply for the job as chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Yeah. He traveled here, took, I think at the time, five weeks to get here.
Wow.
And by the time he got here, classic Israeli story, they'd given the job to someone else already. Knowing he was coming, to Rav Amiel. Knowing he was coming, they gave it, so it turned to be his only trip to Israel in the late spring, early summer 1935. Look, Rav Kook had a vision of what the Rabbanut should be, and I think his vision pertains even today. What I hear very frequently is that, if only there were rabbis like Rav Kook today, then the Rabbanut would have greater respect. So that is actually quite an ahistorical statement. Rav Kook was vilified while he was chief rabbi in a way that the current chief rabbis, or even his predecessor, whom you mentioned before, have never been vilified. He was vilified from the right, from the old yeshuv community, who didn't accept him at all. He was vilified from the left. Now, Rav Kook's greatness was that he was able to nonetheless reach out and see the good in everyone. But to think that in Rav Kook's time, the Rabbanut was universally respected, and then it declined because the stature of the chief rabbis declined thereafter is actually ahistorical, just not true. Rav Herzog was also respected in his time. What's happened the last 40, 50 years is become very the selection process has become very politicized. I'm close with Rav Lau, I think he's actually an exemplar of what the chief rabbi should be. He's dignified. I mean, the people here should know because he was in Modin for years. He speaks 5-6 times a day in various communities in Israel. I've been with him late at night, where he traveled from. There was one time he traveled. He was saying from Haifa to Kedah. Anyone know where Kedah is? So I happen to know. None of the people I was with knew. Kedah is an outpost east of Shechem, overlooking the Jordan Valley. I think they reached 30 families, and they got a rav, and he came to inaugurate. From Haifa to Kido, which is east of Shiloh, and other places, and then he came to give his shiur 11 o'clock at night here in Modi'in. It's a long day. And his workload is mind-boggling, because when he took office, there were about a half dozen cities that had no chief rabbi. And if the law is, if there's no chief rabbi in a city, it's the rabbi Rashi who's responsible for kashrut in that city. So he's responsible for kashrut in cities that are distant from Yerushalayim, but he refused to sign off on what had been signed off on before without knowing. He had to visit with his staff. He had to visit every city. It's a half dozen across the country. And between that and the Geirut and the example that he sets of love for Jews is one that you want. So I think part of the discontent that exists with a chief rabbi or chief rabbinate is part of the discontent that exists for the rabbinate in particular. Western man these days, goes back I guess to the 60s, has a difficult time with authority. And the rabbi is an authority. He's not the only authority, but he is an authority. Let's put it very simply. No one wants to be told what to do. Contemporary human beings do not want to be told what to do. Not by rabbi, for children, not by their parents, not by their employer. They don't want to be told what to do. And so that type of criticism then goes with the job. But I think it has a very important role to play. The Rav, you should know, did not like the ceremonial aspects of it. But the truth is, there's much more to it than the ceremonies.
Okay, I'll place three. You have a model of a position of a chief rabbi in England with Rabbi Sacks. I won't speak about Rabbi Mervis, Rabbi Sacks. You have a model of the chief rabbinate. I don't know if you're familiar with South Africa.
Right, Rabbi Goldstein, yeah.
Well, prior to that, Rabbi Harris.
Okay. Cyril Harris, right.
Cyril.
Right.
And the chief rabbinate here. And I see different nuances in structure in these three and the role, mainly between what you would term the spokesman relationship with the non-Jewish community, the ceremonial, the front man, and the Beth Din, which is totally separate in those communities. And the position here, what would the model that you would...
So you left out a fourth community, and that's the United States, and the chief rabbi of the United States.
But I'm here.
That's right. And that's the answer. There is none. Why is there no chief rabbi of the United States? So obviously Britain and South Africa, and I imagine Australia, have this notion of ecclesiastical authorities that are paid by the state.
Not Australia.
Australia doesn't. No. Okay, so then the community accepted it. Mm-hmm. America, the American ethos, and I think most people are American, but the American ethos, don't tread on me, it goes back to the Revolutionary War, don't tell me what to do, and certainly don't make yourself a rabbi over me. All right? There's a famous story that when Rav Yaakov Yosef, RJJ, was appointed the chief rabbi of New York, it was a very unhappy tenure he had there, but when he came, there was tremendous resentment that he was coming. He was the Maggid of Vilna and the other rabbis in New York, and he's coming, the chief rabbi of New York. So a guy walking down the street, there's a sign, chief rabbi of the United States. Hmm. Someone walks in and says to the fellow, "Who made you chief rabbi of the United States?" So he said, "The sign painter." Which is really the way, that was the attitude of the people.
Okay.
So I don't know much about the UK or South Africa or Australia to know why it's necessary. In the UK, for sure, it just modeled on the Church of England and the other official churches that they have. So there, it's to give kavod to the Jews, like they're giving kavod to the Anglicans. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Here it's different. All the cases you mentioned, except for here, of course, you're dealing with the exile. In the exile, the Torah is going to operate in a much more limited sphere. Mm. Not only ritual, you want, obviously, Jews to be ethical as well, but it has no political/national dimension. In Israel, it's different. Mm-hmm. In Israel, I see, from my perspective, and I think this is how Rav Kook saw it as well, the chief rabbi should not only be in charge of kasher, gerut, ishut, etc., but he should be involved in the issues of the day. All right? I was actually critical back in the day because the chief rabbis were silent during Oslo. Silent. Silent during Gush Katif. Silent. And it bothered me at the time. Now, there is the state employees, but wouldn't it be nice if, let's say they don't have, they're not paskening, they're not deciding the issue, but wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a moral issue on the table in the Knesset, in the cabinet, and they consulted the chief rabbis as to what would be the halachic or hashkafic implications, all right? Shalit, Iskat Shalit, for example. What would be the halachic, hashkafic implications of doing this? The fact that they don't, or I don't say they never do, it does happen on occasion, but the fact that it's not widely done is due to the politicization that exists in this country, and the secularization as well. To consult the chief rabbis on anything outside of kashrus, and even that's a stretch for some, but to consult them on moral issues, political issues, military issues, would I think agitate the diehard secular Israeli who does not want to have any attachment to religion at all. He wants a cultural Judaism, not at all an ethical or moral or religious Judaism. So I think the politicians are sensitive to that, but that's also a defect. Because if anything, if the Navi posited we're to be Or LaGoyim, a light to the nations, we're not going to be a light to the nations if every policy is based either on purely political considerations or expedience or just what they feel is the right thing to do without having any grounding in Jewish sources. So it could be the stature of the chief rabbinate could be enhanced, but it's not only the flaw of the institution. Again, it's a flaw in the constituency as well. The constituents have to want it, and the constituents, not just the laymen, but the governmental bodies as well.
Reading between the lines, I would imagine you would support what happened last week, where law was passed or whatever, that monetary and civil issues will go into the Beth Din of the chief rabbinate.
I didn't hear that. I mean, there's been a Beit Din of the chief rabbinate for a while, a long time, I was just at the beginning, right. But there are other Bate Din as well. So what case are you in?
They brought it up in the Knesset, it was passed, or the first reading, that the Beit Din of the chief rabbinate would not only be responsible in the years of conversions, and but it would be expanded, and it would, people, if you and I had a dispute,
right,
we could go to the chief rabbinical
right.
Beth
Look,
Din structure.
Right now, there are dozens of Batei Din in Israel. I think it's a good thing that the chief rabbinate would get involved in that also. You have to be careful how it's run. You know, I've sat for years on the Beit Din of America as a dayan. So I know somewhat about the interior workings of a Beit Din. You have to be careful, but I think it's appropriate.
All right, I'm going to ask one more question, and then we'll open it up to a few questions. I'm not speaking politically.
I don't mind if you do.
I mind if I do.
Okay.
Trump had one phrase. Putting Charles Lindbergh aside, America first. And that was his platform. America first. Would you say that Israel should take the attitude Israel first?
It's a very good question. You know, none of this is original. All right, America first. I don't believe for a moment he had the hostile connotations that Lindbergh had.
That's why I said put
right. Even make America great again. That was Ronald Reagan's slogan back in 1980. So nothing is really new anymore. It's hard to come up with a new catchy slogan. I think every country, Rav Kook in fact wrote this, you know, Chazal say that every country has its, every nation has its own tsar, its own angel, all right? And what it means is that every country has its own personality. Every country, every nation, you know, we like to look at the 70 nations of the world that have now morphed, I think the UN has 210 members now, 3 times 70. But nonetheless, the 70 nations in the world, each with a unique character, and each with something different to contribute to God's world, all right? And if you think about it, there is a different character that exists amongst the citizenry and the culture. But Germany, Britain, Russia, Italy, France, Argentina, Brazil, America, Canada, the American Canada neighbors. But anyone who knows the area will know there's a difference between the Canadian personality and the American personality, all right? So Israel has what it has to contribute also that no other nation can. And if from that perspective, Israel first is a viable and moral policy. I mean, every country has to take care of its own citizens first and make sure that it's expressing its national character. All right, we all know part of the character of the Jews is to be a beneficent people. We recognize that. So obviously, it's always going to play into it. But, you know, we can't be so benevolent that we cease to exist to please those who wish us ill. So therefore, even benevolence has to stop at a certain point. I think if nations prioritize their values, their culture, when it's positive, their values and culture and their self-expression in a way that contributes to the mosaic, which is God's world, then it's a better world. And certainly it's true of Israel as well. I wish Israel would make its decisions in Yerushalayim, not think it has to make its decisions in Washington, D.C., for example. Because the reality is, if they made decisions here and not there, they'd be better decisions, and everything mistader there also.
But, and they're being accused of the same thing.
What's that? You mean in America?
America, there are people who are saying the decisions in America are being orchestrated from Jerusalem.
Yes. You know what's interesting? I mean, I think most people here are here the entire year, or for good parts of the year. I've actually been quite surprised in the last, I would say, 3-4 years, how little Israel makes it into the American tikshoret, American media. I read the Wall Street Journal every day, all right? You can go weeks without Israel being mentioned. You know, even God forbid the terrorist attack, Rahman al-Islam, it doesn't make the news in America. I mean, God forbid 2 people are killed, you know, in a pigua, 4 people shot in Chicago that day. So that takes precedence, and it's much nearer. Israel does not make the news anymore, not like it did in the 90s or the 80s. There's so many worse things happening in the world. So when we look at Israel as a beacon of light, a beacon of prosperity, a beacon of morality, well, none of those things really make the news. You have to be bad to make the news. And therefore, Israel's out of the news. So when Israelis sometimes think that, you know, America makes the decisions, I wish Israelis knew how little the average American cared what happens in Israel. Everybody does not know what's happening in Israel. They know what's happening on, you know, football. That they know. What's happening in Israel, they're not going to know. The educated will know, but they have 10 other concerns. So often we become a little too self-indulgent, and we think the whole world's talking about us. It used to be like that. I remember that you couldn't go a day without... It was a time in the 80s when I practiced law. I was friendly with a Hispanic lawyer when I worked in the Bronx. And he would say to Israel, every day in the Times, something about the Jews, about Israel, every single day in the New York Times. And I once said to him, you know, how many Jews do you think there are in America? So he said, I don't know, 40, 50 million? And I said,
South Africa has more.
Right. So I said, they're barely 5 million Jews in America now. Maybe today, barely 4 million halachic Jews in America. He couldn't believe it. He says, why must I read about Jews every day? They're one of the smallest ethnic groups in America. All right? But that's what it is. God promised us that we would always be in the forefront of civilization because we're movers and shakers of civilization. We are entrusted with the mandate to move mankind in a certain direction towards acknowledgement of the Malchut Hashem. and therefore we can never permanently leave the media, but nonetheless, people should know it's not as much as it was in the past.
Before I open it up to questions, Manny Ahinda, thank you for introducing me metaphorically to Rabbi Prozansky, and thanks.
Thank you also.
I have a request. We'll open it up for questions, and then I'm sure Rabbi Prozansky will not eat and run. You can ask him privately.
Right. Can I make one introductory statement? I just have to tell a story. I was first in this building in the fall of 2007. My in-laws had a place here.
Did it hurt?
What? No, no, no.
Oh, you didn't fall.
No. In the autumn of 2007. And it was my first sabbatical here. And I remember it got late in the day, and I walked outside, and I didn't know where the shul was. So I saw a kid on a bicycle, and I said to him, Eifa Beit Knesset Baizar? Where's the shul in the community? And he said to me, Beit Knesset? Po, in. There's no shul here. All right, I had to go to Kippah Dome to daven. He was—I don't know if he was right or wrong, but it's almost like he was excited. Oh, hey! Thank God now there's a Beit Knesset here also, and not only one. And the spiritual life of this part of Modi'in is secured as well. So I thank you very much.
This year,
at
Rosh Hashanah, we celebrate the
10th
anniversary.
10th
anniversary
with Rabbi David Lau.
Very nice.
Okay, I'm going to ask questions, not speeches, like I always do. And we'll do this for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then we'll whatever. And whoever wants to go see Ach HaGadol can run home and go see Ach HaGadol. Yes, Anna.
Are media reports that you refer to Yitzhak Rabin as a Jew threat accurate? And if they are accurate, do you still hold those views?
No, I missed the question again.
Can you speak louder, please?
Say it again?
Yeah, are media reports that you referred to Yitzhak Rabin as a junior rat accurate?
Right. No, it's not, I was accused of calling him a traitor. I never called him a traitor. All right.
Repeat the question.
Are the media reports that I accused Rabin, Yitzhak Rabin, of being a Judenrat true, and do I still feel that way? So it's a very sensitive issue. The fact I never called him a traitor. All right. What I did say, and I'll be quite open about it, is that I don't know what a traitor would have done differently. Because in America, to give away territory to your enemy is considered a treacherous act. I never said publicly, Judenrat. What happened was I wrote a letter to someone, a private letter, and in that letter, I actually wrote Rabin Junta. All right? There was a time they were finagling the Knesset. Remember the Mitsubishi scandal? They bribed two ministers to join them because they would have lost Oslo II, the vote in the Knesset. And I wrote the Rabin Junta, and then I realized I haven't used Junta since the 70s. No one's going to know what it is. I changed to Judenrat, meaning Jewish Council, that also collaborated with the enemy in order to, and Nebuch cost many Jewish lives. I never said it publicly. It was private, and it was taken public by other people as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, sir.
David Friedman is going to be the new ambassador. He's, from what I understand, the first Frum, CNE, and he's also pretty close to the president. I don't think anyone else has been as close to the president as an ambassador. Do you know David Friedman?
I met him once at a Beit El dinner. He was involved in Beit El for many years. I can't say I know him personally at all. It's interesting for our community because you know, he's roughly the same age and his wife's the same age as many of my contemporaries. And, you know, people knew him growing up. In 20s, 30s, people knew him in business. So it's not as if some stranger coming out of the diplomatic world who's been insulated. So he's actually quite known by many people in the community, although I don't know him personally myself. I think it's a wonderful thing. He has hearts in the right place, ideas in the right place. He has a certain fearlessness and candor about him that is unwelcome in diplomacy, but in the world of reality, it's quite welcome. And who knows what will happen? You know, you need strength here also, not just from the American ambassador, who ultimately just executes the policies of the president. But I think he'll be able to move the policies in a certain direction that should strengthen Israel if there is the appropriate response here, which these days is actually in doubt. Yes?
There seems to be this newer phenomenon called open orthodoxy, open Hillel. Could it be a renaissance of the re-beginning of the emergence of conservative Judaism, or what is it? Please try to elucidate, because from here, it's not happening here in so much as what's going on in America, and you're there. Could you please enlighten us a little bit about...
Yes, the question is about open orthodoxy. Well, from my perspective, you hit the nail on the head. I wrote an article, I think it's now 5-6 years ago, called The Rise of the Neocons. I was the first one to call that movement the neoconservative movement, because essentially they're going down the same road the conservative movement did a little over 100 years ago, nibbling away at the edges of halacha, but even more deleteriously, what they're doing is they are willfully infiltrating Western values and making Torah decisions based on them. And that is never a healthy combination for Jews, because you ultimately just wind up mimicking what the neighbors are doing. And the barometer of what the Torah should say becomes what our neighbors can expect or look for. So yeah, sadly they're making the same mistake, except for in almost every area, whether it's with the women's issues, with Tanakh, rabbinic authority, just one of them, another one of them. And the only issue that they're really stuck on is Mechitza. Because in the 1950s, when the Mechitza Wars took place in America, Mechitza wound up being known as what they call in advertising the Orthodox brand. You have a Mechitza, you're Orthodox. You don't, you're not. So that's when, it was after that, the OU started distancing itself from the OU shuls that did not have Mechitza. It's hard for us to imagine these days. 1960, there were about 250 members of the Orthodox Union, shul members, that didn't have Mechitza. And one by one, they put in Mechitza or moved to the conservative movement. The last one made its decision a year ago, December, I think, December 2015, and they voted not to put in Mechitza, and they left the OU. So now every OU shul has a Mechitza, but because it's the Orthodox brand, a Mechitza, as much as it has to bother their egalitarian instincts, nonetheless, they couldn't call themselves even open Orthodox if they took away the Mechitza. So again, it's nibbled around the edge to take away for some things, not other things, but that remains the holding point. But increasingly, I mean, the OU statement from a few weeks ago, in which they joined with all the mainstream Orthodox organizations in America, whether the OU, the RCA, Young Israel, Torah, rabbis, Aguda, wall to wall in the mainstream, and the Jews in those organizations represent easily 98% of American Orthodox Jewry. They said you can't have women clergies. That'll be a defining line as well, and they have to deal with that issue.
We discussed that this morning, Marsha, at the shir. That's exactly what Rabbi said.
Howie! Old B'nai Shur, I'm sorry.
I see. Okay, one, two, and there was a...
Right here.
Three, and that will be it.
Rabbi, thank you for your candor, and you speak very well. My question is this. There was an article written by yourself about an unusual case of rape. Could you explain exactly what that article was about?
Well, it wasn't an unusual case of rape. What I did was I was dismissive of what they call in America today the rape culture. All right, I mean, there's a statistic that's bandied about for years already. 1 in 4 women on campuses are subject to sexual assault. And it's completely bogus. It's not even logical. No one would go to a shopping mall where 1 in 4 women were assaulted. Why would you go to college where that happened? So it never made any sense. And the reality is, statistically borne out, is that college campuses are safer for women than being off campus. But nonetheless, my point was that the rape culture is not talking about stranger rape or even violent rape. It's talking about situations where essentially there's a toxic brew of alcohol and promiscuity. And then a week, a month, in some cases 2 years later, the woman will claim that she was raped because she didn't really understand what was happening. And all I wrote was, and that's not far-fetched from an Orthodox rabbi, avoid alcohol and promiscuity, and a lot of these cases will go away. A book was just, I think it's logical, a book was just published last week called The Campus Rape Frenzy, which took 350 pages more than I did to make the same point, all the cases, all the statistics, and the lack of due process, and that's the focus, by Stuart Taylor, who's one of the top legal journalists in America, and Casey Johnson's a professor at Brooklyn College. And the cases that they write about, it's haunting. Lack of due process. One case, I think it's the first chapter, a guy has a relation with a woman, all right? And 2 years later, I mean, it's a relationship that, you know, a relationship. Two years later, she claims that she was raped, all right? And there's no due process. He's expelled. It was in Amherst. He was expelled from school. And he appealed, or he sued, actually, because she had texted her friend that night after it happened. She can't believe she did it with him. She invited him to her room. She can't believe she did it to him. And she had someone else in that night also. And none of this made it to evidence. And the guy's life is ruined, all right? So we have all these, you know, it's all in the Torah also. You know, Dina was the first victim, Rahman al-Itzlan. But then you had Yosef, who was falsely accused, just said right after that. So there's a lack of balance. But all I said was that if I don't trust men, that's the bottom line. So the funny thing is, I just assumed in my naivete that the attacks would come from men, because men have difficulty with self-control. But all I said was if women did not invite men into their rooms or behave in a way that made them vulnerable, then they'd be in a much better position. And I think not only should rabbis say that, but every parent who's sending a daughter to college should say that as well. John Kasich, who ran for president, said this at a campaign speech in May. He said, if you tell your daughters, this is what he said, almost verbatim, if you're drunk, if you drink, and then you invite a boy into your room, bad things will happen. So do neither of those. That's my point. What I ran afoul of is one of the outgrowths of political correctness today. A man is not allowed to address this issue. All right, Taylor and Johnson, you know, they're on their own. Only women can write it. So there have been a number of studies, articles by Heather McDonald, for example, and commentary and the Weekly Standard. You could all look it up. Google Heather McDonald campus rape culture and you'll have a whole article, all the statistics. A man can't address it. But the second point reverts to something I said earlier, and that is no one wants to be told what to do. So rabbi's going to tell a woman, don't be promiscuous. Who? How dare you? How dare you get involved in our lives like that? Well, I found that it was important to get in lives. Let me just... men have to be on notice also, and not just women. Women put themselves in situations of vulnerability. But the fact is, every man should know also, if you go with a girl who says, I love you, and you go back to her room, it's not going to matter. And if a week, a month, a year later she accuses you of assault, you are behind the eight ball. So therefore, morality, chastity, cuts both ways. I just have less faith in men than I had in women. Well, my faith in women apparently is not fully justified either, based on the response that I got.
How did you resolve the kasuga?
Yes, so...
Oh, so you were number two?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. A friend of mine who knows very, 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 very little about Yiddishkeit, she was brought up in a church because of the Holocaust. So she asked me, I heard the Jews in Israel, they took away land from the Arabs. Is that true, Lois? I don't know. What should I tell? I told her something, but I'm just curious what you would have told her if she asked you that.
Right. Well, one answer, if you want to be historical about it, is every nation on earth had its start by taking land from the nation that was there already, except those are going to Antarctica. Although I think the Norwegians have claim part of it, and the Russians are coming, but nonetheless, that just...
to an American.
Right, that just... Well, I mean, Americans have to deal with the Indian issue, so it's
not...
But really, I think among certain groups in America, there's lingering guilt over the Indians. Look, Teaneck was an Indian tribe. I mean, it's not as if it's being hidden. The Teaneck Indians, that was the name of the tribe.
What can I say to make it...
You could say to her like this, that the it's actually not true that the Jews came back to a largely barren, uninhabited land. You could show her Mark Twain's article, 1886, Innocents Abroad, that he saw widely the barrenness, the desolation, and the emptiness of the land. He said he traveled for days, didn't see even any Arabs. So they came back to a land that was largely uninhabited, under the sovereignty of the Ottoman Empire, to whom the Jewish National Fund, among other groups, paid good money to buy land, and that's how the Jewish community in Israel started. It didn't get started by stealing land from Arabs.
But it says it in the newspaper, in the Jerusalem Post, on the first page, that the land, if the Arabs can prove that it's their land, then the Supreme Court might rule against
them. Yes, well, look, the court's politicized as well, but I'll tell you a story no one here knows. I didn't know until this morning. It was at a conference this morning, and the President Rivlin spoke, and he held up a document. Kushan, he owns 58 acres of 58 dunam of land in Ramallah. All right? Go enforce it. But he owns land there as well. A lot of the land that's owned, even by these people claiming possession of the land, it's not as if they have a title to the land that should be recognized in any legitimate court. Hussein, when he controlled that area, distributed parcels of land to his acolytes. Of course, when he was defeated and his sovereignty lapsed, there's no logical reason why the successor owner of the land should adhere to his arbitrary disposal of those parcels of land. A new sheriff's in town. There's a new owner. You were there illegally, so you have no right to give it to them. But unfortunately, the court is politicized. They've not yet, they don't see it that way.
Last question.
He's a ringer, by the way.
I know.
As a well-educated attorney,
yes.
Are you upset by Donald Trump's lack of understanding of the separation of powers mandated by the Constitution and his disrespect for the judiciary?
No. No, but I'll tell you why. What goes for the bagats here goes a hundredfold for the courts in America. I gave a shiur this past Shabbos in Chashmonaim on refugee rights going to the Torah. I started by reading from the relevant statute in the United States. It was back in the 1950s. Congress gave the president the discretion to determine any class of aliens that he wants to bar for any amount of time he wants to bar them, period. That's what the statute says, as long as there's a security reason that's given for it. That's the statute. So, but the courts are politicized. I mean, you would know, but people should know, the Ninth Circuit is notorious as the most far left in the nation. 90% of their cases that are appealed to the Supreme Court are overturned because they don't follow the law. They follow what feels good to them. What's that?
86.
I was rounding up. So they're not following the law, and that's, as a layman, that's his frustration. There's an article today by John Yoo. Who? You. Now, John Yoo is a professor now, I think, at Pepperdine. He's a deputy attorney general under George Bush Jr. and someone else in the Wall Street Journal. So, look, he took issue because he thinks it's counterproductive. On the other hand, where does it say a president can't criticize a court? Obama criticized the Supreme Court justice who sat before him at the State of the Union address. All right, Roosevelt said words in 1937, spoke of the U.S. Supreme Court in a way that was even more degrading than what Trump said. And if you would just take the quote from FDR without attributing it to him, you would think Trump said it, except the articulate nature of the words that were said. You would think he said it. He's completely disparaging of the court, that they're all political, they're not judges, and of course, he brought other cases going back to, you know, Trump's heroes, Andrew Jackson, famous statement, John Marshall may have decided, now let him go enforce it, all right? Lincoln also didn't follow the Supreme Court and had harsh words. So Trump's not the first, but you've been here a few weeks already and realize how polarized America is. For some, he'll never do anything right. It's only wrong, all right? Someone said a few weeks ago that if Trump cured cancer, they would say, why didn't you cure AIDS? What's wrong with you? You're against the AIDS patients. We'll always be able to find fault with him. So I think you and his partner of the article are correct, John Yoo, that at a certain point it's counterproductive because the process is still going on. And you don't want to tick people off. And to think they're not human beings but legal automatons is also not true. They're human beings as well, so you don't want to tick them off. On the other hand, this is who he is. He reaches above the media to the people with his tweets, all right, Twitter. I'm not part of that world, so I don't pay attention to it. He reaches right directly to them. No filter, says whatever's on his mind. Sometimes it's counterproductive, but I think, I just saw this the other day, Thursday or Friday, 55% of Americans, going to one poll at least, support the executive order. So therefore, he's not far off from where the people are, and certainly his people who voted for him, they like that kind of in-your-face rancor. And that's the situation.
Those people don't remind you of Hitler's supporters?
No, not in the least. Not in the least. No.
That's not appropriate.
Yeah, you'll get lynched. No.
Okay, we're going to close this. From my perspective, toda.
I hope it was interesting.
It was fascinating. And prior to tonight, I read his volume one of the
Jewish Ethic of Personal Responsibility.
The concept of personal responsibility, that a person has to pay a consequence for his actions. It's a marvelous sefer, and now he's working on volume two, going through the parshiot, and I haven't seen it in the bookstores here.
Geffen published in Yerushalayim, so they would have it. They know where it is.
Oh, okay. And I encourage you to take a look at
that. That's all I have there right now.
And good luck on your second volume.
Thank you.
And personally, it's been a pleasure seeing you in the flesh.
Likewise. Thank you all very much for coming.
Not like on campuses.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Now I'm going to ask...